Well, it is so good to be able to stand before you this morning. There were occasions when I didn't think it would actually happen, but it's great to be here. Thank you so much for everyone who's supported us and who's prayed for us and who's also shared so many good gifts in terms of food gifts with us in our home. So thank you so much. And can I say welcome to this, the second talk in our series on Paul's letter to the Romans, which we've entitled The Power of Grace and the Life of Faith. And I'm going to be focusing on those two particular verses that were read by Jenny this morning. I just need to begin by making a couple of comments about the context, the place in which these verses arise. As you read through the various letters of Paul, one of the themes that he keeps coming back to again and again and again is this idea of the amazing grace of God that God should give to him, drop in his lap, if you like, the mystery. This mystery that God was going to reveal, was revealing to him. A mystery that was amazing because it was given to him, Paul, after all that Paul had done. I mean, he was the least of the apostles, and he was the one who had actually persecuted the Christians. And yet God had entrusted this mystery to him. And you get a sense of that, for example, from Ephesians chapter 3 and verses 8 to 9, when Paul says this. He says, "Although I am the least of all God's people, this grace was given to me to preach to the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ and to make plain to everyone the administration of this mystery, which for ages past was kept hidden." It was a little bit like God was saying to Paul, "Paul, I want you to come across here and I want you to check this out. Have a look. Here's the mystery. Isn't it amazing? Now I want you to go and take that and to share that with the world." Imagine that you were working in a laboratory around about the year 1928. And you happened upon this this mold, this spore that you identified as penicillin. And you understood immediately that this penicillin would actually save the lives of countless hundreds of thousands of people on the battlefield who'd been, in some sense, wounded and as a result were suffering from septicemia and things like that. You realized that this penicillin had abilities to stop that sort of thing happening. It had an antibiotic sort of effect. If that was you and you made this discovery, don't you think you'd want to get it out there as quickly as possible? Wouldn't you want to share it with the world? And there is a sense in which that's true for Paul here. God has given him this incredible mystery, dropped it in his lap, as it were. And there is a recognition that he has to share this great mystery with the world. Not only because of its great benefits for humanity, but also because it was something that God had entrusted him with. So Paul was under obligation. And you can see something of that in verse 14, which John touched on last week, when Paul says this, "I am obligated both to Greeks and to non-Greeks, both to the wise and to the foolish." And the mystery, what was it? It was that God had made it possible, God had opened the way for Gentiles to now be included amongst his special and favorite people. People who were now able to enter into the special relationship with God, which had previously been excluded from the Gentiles and had been reserved solely for the Jews. And you can see that, I think, also from last week in verse 15. "This is why I am so eager to preach the gospel also to you Greeks and non-Greeks who were at Rome." In the words of Ephesians, this mystery was to preach to the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ. That was the mystery that God had revealed to Paul. And what I love about our church at Graceful is that I think there is a recognition among most of us that we are not here for ourselves, that we have a mandate from God to share this wonderful news, the gospel, with our world. People need to know that God has thrown out a lifeline that will change their lives. And so as we come to our passage this morning, verse 16, I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes, first of all for the Jews, then for the Gentiles. We need to understand something of how countercultural this was for Paul's own contemporaries, for his Jewish friends. And as soon as he began to speak about the fact that God would embrace the sinful Gentiles, immediately, from all that we see in the book of Acts and elsewhere, immediately his contemporaries heaped abuse upon him. He was attacked from all sides. He was accused, for example, of violating the law of Moses, of making God a co-conspirator in sin. These Gentiles, you've got to recognize from a Jewish perspective, were despised. They were regarded as unclean, as sinful. They weren't circumcised. They didn't obey the law. They didn't keep the Sabbath. They didn't obey the food laws. They didn't keep the festivals. And the question they were asking was, how could a holy God embrace such sinful individuals? And what's more, what about God's promises to Israel that they would be his favorite people? Was he now breaking faith with Israel? So all the abuse that was being heaped on Paul, often abuse accompanied by violence, might put a bit of context to verse 16 when Paul says, I am not ashamed of the gospel. And what he's in effect saying is, the abuse, the verbal attacks, the physical violence will not shame me into silence. I am not ashamed. Why? Well, because it's such a powerful thing, this gospel, this good news. It's the way of salvation for both Jews and Gentiles. Now, I need to say a little bit about this word salvation, because I think it's something that is a theological term that we don't often recognize. When we visited South Africa, it must have been about 5 years, 6 years ago, I and my son, Mitchell, went swimming in this, it was a little bit like a bay with sort of like a rocky outcrop on both sides and a little sort of mouth that ran into the ocean. And as the tide receded, the water would flow more strongly, the current would increase. And we were swimming in this little bay and we were quite fine, quite happy. And suddenly these two youngsters, true story, these two youngsters were messing around on the rocks next to this bay and they suddenly fell in, clothes and all. And immediately they were caught up in this current and they couldn't swim. And so it was a case of, help, we're drowning. And Mitchell, who's a good swimmer, and I swam over to them and we flipped them onto their backs and we began to pull them out of the current to safety. Now I tell you that story because I am absolutely convinced that we saved their lives. I have no doubt that if we were not there, they would have drowned. Their fate would have been on the midnight or on the evening news. And I think that's something of the idea in the word salvation here, that God has, as it were, plucked us out of the mess that we've got ourselves into because of our own foolishness. God has saved us in that sense. But I think there's more to it than just that. I think there's a sense in which we need to understand that salvation can be seen from different perspectives. In other words, if somebody says to you, are you saved? I know that many of us would say, yes, I am. But I think you'd be wrong to say that. I think what you should say is, yes and no. Yes, I have been saved from the penalty of sin through the death of Jesus, through the cross. But at the same time, I am being saved from the effect of sin in my own life, from the struggles that I have with sin right day by day in the present. And what is more, I will be saved one day when Jesus takes me home to be with himself. And so you have these three different sort of aspects, past, present, and future. And What Paul does in the rest of the letter is basically he does develop those ideas further. In fact, what he's doing in verses 16 and 17 is he's giving us a heads up on what's still to come. So, for example, in chapters 1 to 3, Paul tells us that there is no one righteous, no, not one. Everyone has sinned. Everyone has fallen short of God's glory. We all, both Jew and Gentile, are deserving of God's judgment. But thank God for Jesus, because through his death and resurrection, we have been saved from that fate. And then from chapter 6 following, Paul will demonstrate that God did not forgive us merely to abandon us, but he forgave us that he might also work within us, to change us, to deliver us from our ongoing struggle with sin. And in a way, we all know something of this in our own lives, that struggle that you have where on the one hand, you do love God and you want to please him and you want to do what's right in his sight and you want to be his faithful servant and you want to live holy lives. But at the same time, there's this principle within you, there's this inclination to do the very opposite, to serve your own sinful ends, to live your own life your own way. And it's a struggle that we're all engaged with. And God's intention is that he might save us from that. He wants to change us. He wants to make us into a special and a holy people. And he does that through the work of the Spirit of Jesus, working in our hearts. So I was saved from the penalty of sin. And I am saved from my struggle with ongoing sin. And then thirdly, I will be saved from the presence of sin when God takes me home to be with himself. And Paul will also deal with that particular theme later on in the book of Romans in chapter 8 and following, where he speaks of how we all along with all of creation are eagerly awaiting our deliverance from death and decay. So it heads up on what's coming. The other day I was at the low point in my recovery. My legs were in agony from the operation of the knee replacements. I was anemic from the bleed. I was continually experiencing waves of nausea, and I had no energy at all. And I was in quite a bad way, and I then began to listen to this song by City Alight. I am hoping that Dave will teach it to us, but the words of the chorus go like this. Yes, I am running. Won't be long till I am home. Yes, I am running. Jesus, take me safely home. And it's amazing how just the emotion that wells up when I began to read those words. I'm sure you've been there too, where things have got pretty desperate and you feel pretty awful. And there's a sense in which I would welcome going home to be with my Lord at this particular stage. But not everybody thinks like that. Not everybody feels that way about death. And John Stott, in a sermon that I listened to, he shares a quote from Woody Allen, who in a sense epitomizes something of the fear that people have about dying. And I want to quote some of the things that Woody Allen says. He says this, he says, today I am a star, but what will I be tomorrow? A black hole? I am not afraid of dying. I just don't want to be there when it happens. I don't want to gain immortality in my books. I want to gain immortality by not dying. And then he adds, death is absolutely stupefying in its terror. It renders human accomplishments absolutely meaningless. Now, not everybody feels like that, but there are a number of people who do. They're terrified of the very thought of dying. But we as Christians do not need to be afraid, because Jesus has delivered us from death and decay. And he offers something far more wonderful in return. Paul expresses it this way. He says this, our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed to us. The glory of seeing Jesus face to face. the glory of being with Him in His kingdom forever. I have been saved, I am being saved, and I will be saved. So the question then is, how does this salvation come about? How do we enter into it? How do we experience it? And the answer, of course, is, well, you must become a Jew. You must get circumcised, observe the Sabbath and all the food laws, offer animal sacrifices, keep all the rules and the regulations and the Torah. No. No, it comes about simply through believing. It's all it's required, just to believe, to embrace the message about Jesus. And you can see that in verse 16. It's there in the verse. The gospel is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes. Everyone who believes. First for the Jew and then for the Gentile. It's nothing that we can do to merit this salvation. We can't earn it. It just needs to be received. To believe is to have faith. To believe is to embrace the truth that Jesus has died for me. And because of that death, I can be forgiven. And I think that this is the sticking point for many people. There might even be some here who find it incredibly difficult. Not to believe that Jesus has done what He's done, but to accept something for nothing. To not have to do anything in response is something that people find incredibly difficult. As a student, and I might have told you this story before, I was hitchhiking from Zimbabwe down to Cape Town, which was a distance of some 2,500 kilometers. And almost immediately, I got a lift from a young girl in a little Mini Cooper. And on the way, I tried to actually help pay for the cost of the petrol, and she refused. She said, "No, it's on me." And when we got to Johannesburg, some 750 miles, she said, "Where are you going to stay in the night?" And I thought, well, wherever I can put me, you know, put my sleeping bag down, that's where I'll sleep. She said, "No, come and stay with my family." And she took me home to her family, and we had a great meal. And as I got into bed at night, between the sheets, there was already a hot water bottle. Next morning, they drove me about 40 k's out of the metropolis into a place where it would be a whole lot easier to catch a lift and the next stage of the journey to Cape Town. And I just want to share with you, what I found incredibly difficult was that I could not do anything to repay them. Everything in me said, I must give them, here, can I give you some cash? And no, we don't want anything. And just to accept it as an act of grace and generosity was incredibly difficult. And I think there are many people who find it very difficult to merely receive the gracious gift of God's salvation. They feel they must do something. Their pride will not allow them to merely receive it. They must earn it. And as a result, they never find it. Because it is a gift that God gives freely. And must be received graciously. So the question arises then, if this is true, if God has now opened up his special people, if you like, to the Gentiles, then what about the law? And what benefit is there in being a Jew? Will God break His promises to His favorite people? And if God welcomes sinners without them having to prove themselves, how can He be righteous in doing that? How is that just? Would a righteous God merely forgive sinners? And what Paul does and what follows in the rest of Romans is he methodically and logically and consistently develops an argument in which he answers each one of those objections. But for the moment, he wants to assert this one thing, that in the gospel, God's righteousness is vindicated. God is never less than absolutely righteous and holy. And you can see that in verse 17. For in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last. Just as is written, the righteous will live by faith. And in what follows, Paul will show us, in the rest of the letter, he will show us that God in himself is always righteous, never less than holy. But he will also demonstrate that God's actions, what God does, is always consistent with his holiness. He always acts justly. And there is nothing immoral in forgiving sinful people because God has made provision for that in terms of the atoning sacrifice of Jesus on the cross. God is righteous in all that he does. But I think the most surprising thing about Paul's statement here is this, that God not only acts justly and righteously, but he gives us his righteousness. He imparts his own righteousness to us. Like a cloak, he covers us with his own righteousness. Now, you might not know this, but we are privileged this morning to have within our congregation a number of saints with us this morning. And I just want to say welcome, folk. And they are saints not because they have a glow about them. And they are saints not because they have committed themselves to a life of service and self-sacrifice. And they are saints not because they have miraculous powers. No, they are saints in a biblical sense because God has clothed them with his righteousness. And if you believed in Jesus, if you received and accepted the work that he's done for us on the cross, then you too are one of them. You too are one of God's saints, one of God's holy ones. And that's why we can approach God as sinful people. How can we approach a holy God? Well, because he has covered us with his righteousness. That's how come we've got access into his presence. And this theme he will also develop later on in the body of his letter. So to summarize then, you will be tempted to be ashamed of the gospel. You will be. It makes it very hard in our own society because we're all the time told to keep it to ourselves. But don't be, because it's the power of God for the salvation of all people. And the key to this saving power is faith. It's believing. You must believe. You must receive this gift of salvation as a free gift. You cannot work for it. You cannot earn it. You must merely receive it. You must believe. And when you do, at that very precise moment when you accept this for yourself and you put your faith and trust in Christ's work on the cross, all of the benefits of Jesus' death and resurrection immediately become yours. As I said, we'll hear more about these things in the weeks that lie ahead. I just want to make a comment, and that is that if you're looking at Romans, it does all link together. Everything flows from the thing that's preceded. And therefore, if you want to get the full benefit of this study on the book of Romans, I just want to encourage you, make sure you come every week. If you miss a week here and a week there, you lose the plot, if you like. You lose the argument. Come weekly. And if you can't make it on a particular Sunday morning because there's a baptism or something like that that's happened, you can come in the evening because we have a duplicate service at 5 o'clock in the evening. And you're most welcome to join us for that. It's a duplicate service, the same message. So if you miss out on the morning, come in the evening and get the full story. So do join us next Sunday for the next installment in this exciting letter to the Romans.